Warning, do not listen to this podcast if hearing about freedom and liberty is not legal for you in your community. And if so, you should immediately move to a hipper community.
Welcome to the Freedom Fiends Podcast, a weekly web lab where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati cover the punk rockinist, hip-hopinist current events, as well as timeless universal truths about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because there's no such thing as half-free. The Freedom Fiends Podcast, available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com.
Okay, we're rolling.
This is the Guns and Weed Podcast with Michael Dean and Nima Vedati. I'm Michael Dean.
I'm Nima Vedati. Welcome back, folks.
Yeah. So today we want to talk about medicine.
Medicine, baby. You got it. In general, too, not just... This is the Guns and Weed Podcast, and yes, we do talk a lot about weed being medicine and the problems associated with trying to get it as medicine, but I guess we can talk about just the whole thing in general. Isn't that right, Mr. Dean?
Yep. My daughter died of cancer, died of leukemia, and she had to break the law to get medical marijuana. I don't smoke pot, but the thought that someone could have thrown her in a cage for something that relieved her intense suffering just makes me hate the war on drugs. Makes me just that's part of why I'm doing this. That's part of why I wanted to make the movie, and part of why we're doing this podcast. And my mother also died of cancer. She did not get medical marijuana, basically because she thought marijuana was immoral, because she grew up in a generation where that was a bad thing, and she didn't consider it. And instead, she took a lot of narcotics that made her foggy and probably didn't do as good of a job after a while as marijuana would have.
If you don't mind me asking, Michael, why did she think it was immoral? Was it because it was illegal?
Yeah, because she grew up in Nebraska, and she lived in a small town in upstate New York, and she, she was convinced.
And I guess that goes back to the whole legal positivism thing. I see that a lot here where I'm at, people who think just because something's illegal, then it's something wrong. Which I think we address in our movie, and I think we should make that a regular point to address the difference between something being illegal and being immoral or wrong.
Yeah. It's only immoral if you're aggressing on someone and take... Talk a little bit about explaining the non-aggression principle in, like, for someone who's never heard it. It sounds kind of weird. Like, explain it, if you can, in non-libertarian theory wording, just in plain English. Can you do that?
In plain English,
can you possibly do that? Is that possible?
It's wrong to hurt somebody or steal from them. I mean, I guess that's what aggression is. It's me taking something from you or hurting you. Those are the two I can think of, and those can be lumped into aggression. So for the layperson, it's just obvious. I mean, people say it all the time. It's just basic kindergarten stuff. Don't hit, don't punch, don't kill, don't steal. The simple stuff, the stuff we can all pretty much agree to and all do until we get older and we get into this situation where, well, if they're wearing a certain blue uniform or a certain green uniform, then when they kill people or hurt people or steal from them, it's for all of our own good. So we sort of outsource that aggression, and then that's okay. But when you're, I guess, a libertarian or an anarchist, then it's not okay no matter what, no matter who you outsource it to.
I would say everything I need to know about law I learned in kindergarten, but that's kind of not true, because by kindergarten, you're usually convinced that if someone's in that blue uniform and if something's illegal, it's wrong.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, it's kind of, the hippies used to say, anything's okay as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. That's kind of the non-aggression principle, except the hippies had a lot of justification for doing things that did hurt people. Like, it's okay to take welfare, or it's okay to steal, or I've met a lot of hippies who quoted that idea but didn't really live by the non-aggression principle. And a lot of hippies think that people should have their guns taken away to make the world a wonderful, peaceful, loving place powered on unicorn farts. But taking the guns away from peaceful people is initiating aggression. So
right.
And I think a lot of hippies think that all the money should be stolen from the rich people and given to the poor people, which is initiating aggression.
Right. Well, part of the problem is there's this culture that thinks that making a profit is somehow evil or some kind of aggression. If you're the one making the profit off of it, then for some reason that's bad and you shouldn't be profitable.
I know. There's somebody commented on the Guns and Weed movie on YouTube. There's a chapter where someone at Karmaceuticals is talking about, we give people a great deal, we don't ever charge more than $38 an eighth. And some guy was like, $38 an eighth? You guys are capitalists, ripping people off. You're evil. Pot only costs 10 cents an eighth to grow. And I'm like, boy, you poor deluded little kid. And, you know,
right,
I explained him the economics of it. I said, did you see, you know, first of all, they're not just throwing seeds in a vacant lot somewhere. They are putting a lot of time, money, energy, electricity, care, chemicals, food, time, and paying off the state and trying to, you know, make a living.
And risk. And I think that's the important part to remember about why the profit motive is a good thing. Starting a business is a very risky thing. The vast majority of businesses fail when they first start.
And starting a medical marijuana business is even a riskier thing, because even if you do everything by the book and get all the permits in the city, you know, and pay all your taxes and fill out all the forms and get all the permission slips, sometimes they still come in with jackbooted thugs and point guns at your head and take everything and throw you in jail. That's happened in California a lot. And we say in our movie that that happened throughout George Bush's administration and well into Obama's first year. I'm debating updating that for the cut in 2012, because they've started doing that again.
Have they really, in California, at a federal level, they've started raiding again?
Yeah. Well,
I know
I don't know if it's a federal level. I think it might be a state level, because I think there's this weird hippie thing in the California code about medical marijuana that the dispensaries are supposed to be nonprofit.
Okay.
And the government wants to take them out if they're making a profit.
Right, right. You see, the problem with the government deciding and regulating businesses and saying that, well, they can't be not-for-profit, is it's completely morally corruptible, because who defines that? How do you define something as not-for-profit or not? And of course, people are going to try to make – they have to want to make some money off of it. You have to make a decent living at something if you're going to do it. Nobody's ever going to do anything for their own health or the benefit of their own good, at least not something that takes a full day's worth of work all week.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to have to make some money. So then it becomes the regulators deciding. And then it doesn't even become a not-for-profit thing. It becomes a game that you play with the government.
The thing of people hating the idea of making a profit, it seems to me like a really childish idea, not even childlike, but like everything should be free, man. A lot of people who are socialist or lean socialist live with their parents or go to a state college or don't work for a living. You know, it's kind of, DJ and I have really similar experiences in our distant past, way before we met each other, of telling our capitalist Republican fathers, man, you're bad. Capitalism's bad. Communism is where it's at. And, you know, I think I was 15 when I said that, and I think she was 17 when she said that. And both of our fathers patiently and bemusedly said basically the same thing, which was, wait until you're earning a living and then tell me that. And, you know, they were both right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think anybody who starts to get a cursory knowledge of the way economics really works understands that you need that free price structure. Otherwise, you don't know what prices are going to be. That's why the Soviet Union collapsed. You have to have the market decide what the prices of everything is, and that includes labor. That's why, you know, things like minimum wage laws are just utterly silly. You can't write things down on paper or say things should be a certain way and expect them to be that way. You have to operate in reality.
Speaking of the Soviet Union, I lived through the Cold War, and all of the propaganda right now of how Muslims want to kill us, which is, you know, there are a few of them that definitely want to kill us, but most of them don't, but they're all kind of painted with this broad brush. In the 60s and 70s, when I was a kid, it was the Russians. And it was like, Middle Easterners were like, oh, those simple sandal-wearing rug makers, you know? Like, oh, I enjoy the rugs they make in Persia. I had Persian rugs as a kid. My mother ran a store where she sold Oriental rugs. It was called the Oriental Bazaar, if you want to know how far back that was. You can't even say Oriental anymore. Yeah, she sold a lot of stuff from the Far East and the Middle East. And, you know, I grew up with a Persian rug on my floor, and now I've got a Persian best friend. It's kind of cool, Nima.
Yeah, there you go. I grew up with a Persian rug too.
And did you
probably because I'm Persian?
Did you grow up with a Persian best friend? Or did you have some little toe-headed...
Actually, I did, yeah.
Did you have some little toe-headed blonde-haired friend?
I also had a blonde friend. It was in Salt Lake, so I did luckily have a Persian friend, but I also had the blonde Mormon friend down the street. So.
Yeah, I think I've... Not to sound sappy and needing to say no homo after it, but I don't know if I've, like... I wouldn't say I've known you many lifetimes or I've known you since before I met you, but I think I was meant to know you. I think... We complement each other in some cool way. No homo.
Word. We make a good team.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of freedom, right? I mean, I didn't have to go through some government czar, a friend-finding czar to find
a
you.
You just sort of,
it happened spontaneously.
The Facebook friend-finding czar has hooked me up with people who say, you disgust me and make me want to throw up.
Exactly. Because nobody can know who's better to be your friend than you, right?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of, like, we were talking a couple episodes ago about the wonders of the internet. You know, it is really cool in a way, like, the friend findings are when friend finding bot, when it's combined with your own intelligence. Because I add people that I don't know and add friends of friends based on, hey, maybe I'd like this person. And occasionally they say, you make me want to throw up. But, you know, like today, one of them said, hey, we want to show your movie in the Philadelphia Independent Film Festival. And it's like, I never would have found that guy if I hadn't poked around on the internet and taken the friend finding bot's suggestions a little further and done it on my own.
Yeah.
But we're...
So really, you make people want to throw up, Michael?
Yes. You know, I have my whole life. I mean, I remember in college, one day I decided I want to be free. I was walking with my friend across the parking lot from his car to class, and I took off all my clothes, put them under my arm, and walked across the parking lot naked, and then walked up to the school building and put my clothes back on and went in. And a day later, this beautiful woman, like really shy, beautiful woman I've never talked to before, walked up to me and said, you know, I've really admired you from a distance, but after what you did yesterday, I think you're a horrible person. And, you know, I did stuff like that going back to kindergarten. I mean, in kindergarten, I was just like, you can't tell me what to do. You're not my mommy. My mommy can't even tell me what to do. So, yeah, right. I've always, you know, if you don't piss somebody off, you're not doing it right.
Right. Although, I think I've always had a streak like that, too. I can remember freshman year of high school. I was my mom was a teacher at the first grade, and it was all, you know, in the same complex. Back then, it was a smaller school district. And so I was walking from the high school to my mom's classroom, and I walked past the buses that everybody were getting on. And some lady asked me for my bus pass, and I was like, I'm not going to ride the bus. And she's like, well, you need your bus pass to be here. And I was like, my mom works here. I'm just going to walk there. Is it okay if I just walk, you know, a few feet into the door? And she's like, no, I need your bus pass.
You need permission to stand.
You need permission to stand. And so her and another woman grabbed me, and they were going to take me to the principal. And they're like, walk with us. We're going to get you some discipline. And so I said, how fast can you ladies run? And they looked at me, and I just jetted. I bolted and ran to my mom's classroom and hid there. And apparently I got away. Nobody – because they actually asked some of the fellow students what my name was, and nobody could figure out how to spell it, so they couldn't look me up in their system.
Does not compute.
Yeah. Vidoggy? Vidoogie? Yeah. What?
I remember when computers had punch cards.
Punch cards. Wow. Yeah. That's ancient.
Our phone bill used to come printed on a punch card, and it said, like, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. I don't know what spindling is, but I always wanted to fold them and mutilate them.
Yeah.
The first time I ever used a computer was I was like nine. It was in New Hampshire at my sister's college, and she took me into the mainframe room. I think I told you this. I got locked in the bathroom for a half hour, and that made me hate computers forever for a long time.
But computers today look nothing like that.
Oh, so. I know. I mean, this was like a room with a bunch of dumb terminals connected to like another room, and it was like to do something on the computer then – you would type in your program, it would print punch cards, and then you'd bring them to, like, Moses, you know, this computer guy in a lab coat, literally, who would, you know, like, you had to go through this God figure who had a God complex, and if he felt like it, he might take your stuff in and run it through, and the next day give you a printout of your result.
Right,
and that's how it worked back then. You know, Ban Francisco, you were talking about needing permission to stand. Ban Francisco, where I used to live, just passed a law against sitting or standing on the sidewalk anywhere in the city between 8 in the morning and 11 p.m. at night.
Really? Is that an anti-homeless kind of thing or what?
Yeah, it's really the Hate Street merchants got together. It's really about Hate Street. And I saw an article about it, and they're like, yeah, the Hate Street Merchants Association was like, yes, hopefully this will finally clean up Hate Street. And I'm like, clean up Hate Street? Hate Street has been an open sewer since like 1961.
Right. You they're always one or two laws away from perfection. Isn't that it?
Yes. Yeah, I like that quote. Who was that? It was our buddy.
Oh, yeah. Wayne? No.
Yeah.
Is it?
Our good friend. What's his name?
Regardless, it's a great quote. We'll give credit if we can.
So I think we're talking about medicine. You had some stuff to say.
Yeah, we kind of got off on a tangent there.
But, you know, I think people like that about this podcast.
I haven't had insurance for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I haven't had insurance since I've been, you know, my own adult, since I left the parents' house. And, you know, when I get sick, which is rare, all I want to do is, you know,
get
some medicine, get some antibiotics. I can usually tell. I don't think I would abuse antibiotics. And I can never get them, you know? It's just ridiculous to me that the problem is that there's a system of all these layers
of going to this god figure to pay him to bless you
right,
with your medicine.
Right. And it's just like, why can't I go to the store and buy something I need like anything else?
although to play devil's advocate for this, and maybe you can talk about a solution for this, in Mexico, you can get antibiotics out of a bin with no prescription, or you could for a long time. And people did abuse them. They'd get a viral cold, like something that's a virus, flu, mm-hmm. that isn't treatable with antibiotics, and they'd take them anyway. And it has allegedly having diseases that are immune to antibiotics.
Because supposedly most people take them when they don't need them, kind of a thing?
Yeah, or they take them more than they need them, yeah.
They take them more than they need them?
That's what the non-libertarians would say. What would you say to that?
I have no doubt that might there might be a problem with that, but I don't think that there is a centrally planned solution to it. I suppose, just like anything else, it seems the market would handle that better than any bureaucrat deciding and centrally planning how many people need to take antibiotics.
I think the germs laugh at the thought of a bureaucrat legislating against them.
Exactly.
Like, you're just an ant, man. You can't tell me what to do.
Right. And it seems like anytime these things come up, like, you know, we have to do this for the greater good, it just seems like they never – the central planners, the people who make the laws, the people who think up these laws, who are they to say what is best for the greater good? The only way the greater good gets worked out in nature, in evolution, in anything, is the aggregate of all the different tiny decisions, tiny changes made. And so it seems like, why inhibit us? Why not allow that system to play out? Why not allow me to interact with the world on my own to try to get my own medicine and try to make my own life better, rather than some vague sense of planning it all out and it'll all work out in the end if you just have enough control of it?
A thing that people have to remember about bureaucrats, and this is important for anyone who's new to this kind of thought, you know, really we're making this podcast, we're not preaching to the choir. We're not making this for people who already understand it. We're making it for me at 20, you know, a liberal who, or just someone who thinks that the government's here to help them, but maybe doesn't like authority. And I think there's a lot of people out there like that. That's who this podcast is for mainly. Anybody else is welcome to listen and seem to be enjoying it. Some of the OG libertarians seem to be enjoying it a lot. But the thing that the people new to this need to know is that bureaucrats aren't just some math geek with a clipboard in an office somewhere. They're a math geek with a clipboard in an office backed by an army that wants to kill you. Because bureaucrats can't enforce anything except by the power of the barrel of a gun. And what we mean by that is that literally these bureaucrats make these ideas up, lawmakers put them into law, or sometimes bureaucrats just put them into code, which isn't even law, but is legally enforceable, you know, like the FDA and, you know, the EPA and things like that. And then if you break that law, some government employee will come to your house. You know, like, for instance, if you don't pay your taxes, the IRS bureaucrat with the clipboard will come to your house. More and more often, the bureaucrat has a weapon on his hip. But anyway, a bureaucrat will come to your house, and if you or your office, you know, if it's a business thing, and if you say, get the hell out of here, I'm not going to do what you say, they'll come back with men with guns. And whether it's police or whether it's FDA police or whether it's stormtroopers of death with body armor on and AR-15s, they will come back with guns and tell you to comply. And if you don't, they will point the guns at your head and say, you must comply. And if you refuse, sometimes they will shoot you and end your life. So bureaucrats are guys with a clipboard backed by an army.
Exactly. I think a hilarious recent example of that is, did you hear about, in I think it was Maricopa County, Arizona recently, they used an actual tank with Steven Seagal riding in it to bust a supposed cockfighter. They had a tip from this guy from months ago saying he was running a cockfighting operation. They literally came with a tank.
Because he's got his TV show now.
Exactly.
You know, there's a weird mixture of, like, media and cops now. And it's really weird that the cops love to have the cameras on them when the producer is in their pocket.
Oh, yeah.
But if you point a camera at a cop, they do not like it.
And now, the NEMA News with Nima Vedati.
And now, for your daily dose of nanny statism in our daily segment, Tyranny Today.
Tyranny Today.
No, you remember the guy who was riding his motorcycle with the helmet on? The guy pulls the gun on him? Yeah. And, I don't know how that resolved itself, but I know they took legal action against him for recording it.
I would have shot that guy. And it's, you know, I'm not advocating violence against anybody, but that guy didn't identify himself until like 5 or 6 seconds later. If I were riding a motorcycle and someone stopped their car in front of me, cut me off, jumped out of their car pointing a gun at me, I would kill them.
Right.
I would kill them in self-defense because I would assume that they weren't, you know, an authorized agent of the government. I'd assume that they were coming to kill me and take my bike.
Right. And think about what would have happened to you if that was really the case. You'd have been in jail for life right now.
I'd be in jail for life. Dead. You know,
or dead.
I would have shot him, and if I didn't kill him, he probably would have shot me until he killed me.
Right.
With his government gun. You know, I think that government guns would be a great name for a punk rock band.
Totally.
If there's anybody out there who wants to use that name, let us hear your music. If it's good, we'll let you use it.
It's not very libertarian.
It's not very libertarian,
there,
but
Michael?
No, it is, because it's I own the property of that, and I will sell it for free to someone in exchange for them being good.
Well, that brings up a good debate there.
Intellectual property laws?
Yeah, do you own the property just because you came up with the idea?
Well, put it this way. If some band that sucked just heard this and went ahead and used it, I would not take them to court. Yeah. So my intellectual property law with that kind of thing is not backed up by government guns. It's backed up to, I'm just going to say dumb things about you on the internet.
There you go. That's freedom. Exactly. I mean, and in the end, that's how things like that, these little cultural squabbles, that's how they should be decided. We shouldn't have government
in
things like that.
In a way, the Christians have it right with shame. I mean, I hate the whole thing, and they try to codify shame. Some of them try to codify shame into law sometimes. But really, in a libertarian paradise, I think there'd be a lot more shame in a way. Not over stupid things, but it's like over real things. You know, instead of your neighbors nannying you, you know, hating you for doing something against the state, they'd hate you for doing something against your fellow man.
Again, yeah, that would be the way I think it would work. I mean, if you think about it, that's how society would sort of self-govern itself. I mean, you wouldn't do business with somebody you knew was going to cheat you.
I know.
You wouldn't have in your home somebody you knew was going to rob you. And nobody would. That would be the incentive to not break the moral codes, to not aggress against people.
Which brings up something else I want to talk about, which is deleting bad people from your life. I wrote this book called A User's Manual for the Human Experience. It's kind of a libertarian self-help book, if there's such a thing, and I'll link it in the show notes. It's on Amazon, and it's also available as a free podcast. It's basically about taking non-aggression principle and applying it to people in your life, and it kind of minces the word aggression with the word force. I mean, literally, aggression is always immoral. Force is sometimes justified, especially if it's used to prevent aggression, but I just kind of toned down aggression to force, meaning something that's non-physically violent, but someone's in your life being a parasite. Let's talk about that. You ever cut anybody completely out of your life?
I don't know if I've ever made a concerted effort to cut people out of my life. I move around a lot. Like, I haven't lived in the same place for more than a year.
You burn your bridges?
I guess I don't burn my bridges. I just cross them and tend to
abandon
them if I don't need them. So I take more of a moving forward approach, and I haven't really had many stragglers, I guess, which might be a good thing.
I've had a lot. It's kind of like the William S. Burroughs quote, "The insane have always loved me." I have a bunch of ex-girlfriends. You know, I'm happily married now, And I have a bunch of ex-girlfriends that still try to contact me. And some of them I talk to and I'm friends with. My wife's cool with that. But some of them still feel they have some claim on me or some hold on me.
Right, right.
And, you know, want to be more than friends. Not necessarily that they want to, you know, kill my wife and move in with me, but that they still talk to me, not even necessarily flirty, but like they own me or something.
Right, right.
Or like, or like they, you know, different than a friend would talk to you.
They want you to be in their sphere of influence.
Right. And it kind of creeps me out. I have literally like blocked emails, blocked phone numbers of some people like that. I've done it with some people I played music with. And none of those people are violent. Like, if they showed up in my, if they found me, which would probably require a private detective, if they showed up on my doorstep, I'd tell them to go away. And if they didn't, I'd call the police, which is...
You'd call the police.
I would call the police. And here's why. I've had to put a restraining order on somebody, or I did put a restraining order on somebody one time. And in extreme cases, I think calling the police is not a bad thing to have a record.
To have a record,
of,
yeah.
This person is initiating aggression on me. So if they come back again and pull a knife on you and you shoot them and kill them, there's a record of, yeah, this person's been hassled by this person
right.
before.
Because that's an important thing to have that record. Unfortunately, we have a monopoly where you have to go to the government police to have a legitimate record. That would be the unfortunate thing, I would say.
You don't necessarily, you might eventually, but you know, another thing is just like saving emails and stuff.
Right.
I mean, you can just save, communicate or recorded phone calls if it's legal, you know, to have proof that they've hassled you.
The thing
you,
is, but juries seem to, they place more weight on information that comes from the police department or a sheriff's department.
Yeah,
they always
do.
Will do that.
And my experience with putting the restraining order on somebody was I learned a lot about dealing with the government in that sense. It was basically when I lived in San Francisco, there was this couple that lived upstairs from me and the husband was beating the wife regularly and I was calling the cops. At first I did the neighborly thing. I went up to him and I'm like, dude, don't do that. And he got incensed and was like, no, it's my right. It's my woman. We'll work this out. And I'm like, okay, but it's still noisy and it makes me upset and I have to hear it. Do it somewhere else. And he got up in my face and
go beat your wife at the lake.
Yeah, go beat your wife in the, go to the park and beat your wife. And then he beat her while she was pregnant. And that kind of felt like I need to intervene and pull government guns into this. You know,
that was a long time before you were of this persuasion, though. So do you think you would do the same thing nowadays? Or how would you handle the situation differently?
I don't know how I'd handle it nowadays. First of all, we own a house and don't have upstairs neighbors, which is something I made a conscious decision to do. And my wife and I made a conscious decision to do. You know, it didn't fall into our laps. It took a lot of work and money. You know, where we lived together in California in a house, we didn't have wife-beating neighbors. We didn't have upstairs neighbors. We had loud neighbors, you know, outside the window and in the parking lot. And that kind of bugged me, but that's not something you go out with a gun with.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what I do in that situation. I don't think I'll ever be in that situation. I don't think I'll ever be in the situation of having an upstairs neighbor who's beating his wife's head against a floor that is also my ceiling.
Right, right, right.
But basically, he and his wife both threatened to kill me on several occasions and once in writing. And I just got sick of it. I was more status than I am now, but I didn't believe that a restraining order would stop him. I somehow, like, intuitively or subconsciously in the back of my head knew that if something came to a head, having a record of it would help. And restraining orders don't stop crazy people. They incense them and make them worse. You know, I had him served by the sheriff. You know, I went and filled out papers and went to court and got a the temporary restraining order turned into a 3-year restraining order. The interesting thing I learned about that experience was there were like 5 people in front of me requested begging for restraining orders. And only one of them besides me got one. And one or two of the people who were refused them needed them more than me. I mean, they were like living with a husband that was, you know, I mean, one woman had a broken arm and she got turned down.
Wow.
And the reason they got turned down was either they didn't fill out the paperwork correctly or they were kind of like demanding with the judge.
Right.
You know, and I was really not demanding, really like, well, I really need this. And, you know, like talked the way they like to be talked up to. And it worked. And then I actually got the restraining order, and then I actually moved to a different city the next day. I looked them up on the internet recently, and they're not together anymore. And the woman now works at a battered women's shelter that she went to.
Huh. Good
so,
for her.
I don't know if it had anything to do with me or not, but eventually she got away from the guy.
Good.
But that's an extreme case, and what my book is for is more for people where it's nothing like that, where it's more like people are just in your life weenying and they're not good for you. And I think that it doesn't make sense to be adamant about liberty from the government and then allow non-liberty from friends and family. That's my whole take.
Okay. So how so? Allowing somebody else to control your life? If you still make the voluntary choice, though, your argument then is to voluntarily use your choices to not be around people that, I guess, are bad for you?
Exactly. And I go into a lot more detail in the book about it. But what it basically comes down to, and, you know, this isn't the first book that's been written about this, but it's the first hip book or libertarian book that's been written about this. It basically comes down to realizing that just because someone shares DNA with you doesn't mean you have to put up with their crap. And just because someone wants to be your friend doesn't mean you need to put up with their crap. And just learning to recognize it.
Okay. Fair enough.
The non-aggression principle is do not initiate aggression. And I have what I call the non-aggression principle 2.0, which is do not initiate or accept aggression.
Right. So does that include government aggression then? We should not accept it?
Well, there's varying points of it. I mean, I've had people call me a theorist because they're like, well, if that's true, you should shoot your tax collector and instead I pay my taxes. There's gray areas. It's a continuum. Do you want to be a martyr or do you want to live to fight another day?
Right.
I want to live to fight another day.
You got to pick your battles, I guess. But as long as you don't concede your mind, I think that's the key. It's like Pimp C says, them H's can lock my body, but they can't take my mind. And they truly can't unless you let them.
You can say ho.
I can say ho? Podcast. Okay. I thought there's no
question. Yeah, you just can't say the F word or the S word because we're trying to get on radio.
Okay, so I can say ho ass.
I have granted you. The central scrutinizer has granted us a temporary.
Do I need to fill out a relief. Request? A profanity request?
In octuplicate, yes. So part of how I, you know, a few podcasts ago you were talking about, I really liked your thing at the end. It actually made me feel better hearing it and then listening to it later on the podcast, talking about just not accepting it and just basically stepping out of the system. I grew up in punk rock in DC in the Discord era, at the tail end of the Discord Minor Threat, Iron Cross kind of era, and the Flex Your Head record era. And I remember going to those punk rock shows, and I remember talking to like some of the movers and shakers and that, like Ian MacKay and other people. And a thing that I really liked was their attitude on major labels. A lot of independent bands say, no way, man, we'd never sell out. And it's because no one's ever offered. Mm-hmm. But when someone actually offers, they bend over backwards. But Ian's band Fugazi later, they got offered a $1 million contract and said no. And part of it was integrity, but it was also just that they were running a really successful label out of their house and still are. And just didn't want to be told what to do or have to change it in any way. Right. And didn't want to have to give 50% of their money to lawyers and agents and managers. And they probably actually made more money just doing it on their own with less intrusion and were able to sell their records for less money.
And thank God they were allowed to do that. And people are still luckily allowed to do that. There are some industries where if you don't want to go the establishment route, you're breaking the law.
Yeah. And something I really liked about that whole ethic, the DC punk rock ethic, was it wasn't anti-major label, it was extra major label. Like, it was outside of that system. It didn't exist as a F you, man, to the major labels. It was like they'd stepped out of the road. You know?
It was an alternate route.
And that's kind of what I try to do with government. It's like, yeah, I dot my I's and pay my taxes and do things to keep the men from showing up at my doors with guns. But that doesn't really take a lot of time or effort or even money. You know,
well, It takes more than it should.
Yeah.
And it bugs me every time. You know, it bugs me to have to pay my taxes. It bugs me to have to pay a speeding ticket. It really does.
Yeah, it really does, me too. And I kind of feel like a whipped dog saying, oh, I just pay it. And I kind of have a lot of admiration for people who have the guts to not pay it and go to jail for it. But my freedom to be in my home and out in the world and not have government guns pointed at my head is more valuable to me than the money and time that that takes to do. So I just friggin' do it.
Well, while you're a slave, you have to act nice to the slave masters until you can figure out your exit strategy, right?
And we are kind of lucky in America that we can sit here criticizing our slaveholders just with vitriol every day and not be shot for it, which you are in many countries.
Right,
I mean, I'm not really patriotic. I mean, my patriotism extends for about 5 years of America that happened in the 1700s. But
well, I think you also, everybody needs to separate the government from the people. I mean, it is, yeah, we the people, yada, yada, yada. But I think everybody's realizing that we the people don't run things. It's not us. The United States is not us. It's them.
Well, the way that my wife and I do it is we've declared our home and the property around it a sovereign land. And that doesn't, we have not seceded from America. We have not given up our citizenship. We've just declared our house a sovereign land.
You're a dual citizen,
not nation,
of the United States and Nestlandia.
I am. Exactly. Nestlandia. It's the nest. We call our house the nest, and it's Nestlandia. And it travels with us. Like the car, our car we call the Port-a-Nest. And if we rent a hotel room, we call the hotel room a Rent-a-Nest.
Nice.
And, you know, Nestlandia is basically like 120 foot in every direction, including up, sphere around wherever she or I or both of us are.
When you get felt up at the airport, isn't an invasion of your sovereign nation?
We've made a goal to never fly again. And we did that before George came up with that. I liked that George came up with the, George Donnelly came up with the, we will not fly. And then, what's her name on The View called him a terrorist for that.
Really?
That's hilarious.
You know, they had Alex Jones on The View a couple weeks ago.
Oh, that was great. Did you
see
it?
Yeah, I saw part of it. I don't think I saw the whole thing. He was pretty much just defending Charlie Sheen the whole time I was watching
it. He tricked him. He talked about his friend Charlie Sheen for 5 minutes and then just ranted about his websites for 2 minutes until they threw him off.
Nice.
I like it when people hack the media like that.
Oh, yeah. Anytime people hack any kind of establishment, it's, I think, worthy, admirable.
Yeah, it's valuable.
It's valuable.
You know, I grew up, I read this book when I was a kid called Steal This Book by Abby Hoffman, which was all about hacking the system. I mean, it was kind of violent and it was very socialist, but I read it when I was like 12,
right,
and it really had a big influence on me. Not the violence part or the socialism part, but the, wait, you mean you don't have to always respect the man in the blue uniform just because he tells you to pull down your pants and let him feel you up at the airport?
Right. Ideas, I mean, they evolve. And I think where a lot of people are at now is realizing, yes, that anti-establishment thing, you got to team it up with, you know, your sense of morality vis-a-vis the non-aggression principle.
Yeah.
Once you have that, then you're okay. If you miss that idea that violence is always wrong, then you end up with the kind of socialism and the kind of social programs and laws make everything better ideas that dominate, you know, a lot of Western thought these days.
Punk rock was a big influence for me. I mean, hearing Dead Kennedys made me not trust the government when I was like 17.
Right.
But again, they lean left, and their singer Jello Biafra, you know, stumped for the Green Party. I mean, he believes in the state. He just believes in his version of the state.
Their own version of the state. Yeah.
Yeah. He ran for mayor of San Francisco against Feinstein and came in fourth out of 10th. And he had just a ridiculous, funny platform. It was like, you know, all businessmen will have to wear clown suits and you know, panhandlers will be licensed by the city at 50% commission.
Right. I think that's a big problem that we have to address if our sort of sect, I don't want to call it a sect, but if the liberty perspective is going to win the intellectual battle, I think we have to stop demonizing businessmen just because they're businessmen or just because they make a profit.
I'm a capitalist, but I'm not a corporatist.
Exactly. I think they should be vilified if they're using the guns of the government to rig their game.
A lot of lefties don't understand the difference, and a lot of righties embrace the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Which is both wrong to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, lefties basically think anyone who makes a profit is the devil, and righties think anyone should make a profit. You know, we should make a profit, and the government should help,
yeah, through protection programs, tariffs.
I mean, they scream about the right screams about not wanting federal intervention, but they certainly want their so-called free trade treaties, you know, that tax things that come from other countries.
Right. And they certainly want war, which is the biggest example of corporatism you could think of.
This thing in Libya just to me looks like, of anything in my lifetime, of all the military actions I've seen. And I say that because they haven't declared war since the 40s. But these illegal, immoral military actions all over the world. This one just seems the most blatant, like, let's have a war.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, there's a song by the band, punk band Fear, called Let's Have a War.
It's so brazen. And not only that, but a lot of people are talking about the precedent it's setting. I mean, we've set some precedents before over when it's okay and when the president can actually do that. But now it's not even that, oh, there was this big Holocaust or there's this big cleansing going on. It was a massacre could happen. It hadn't happened yet.
Well, there's
that was the justification.
There are horrible cleansings going on in Somalia and Darfur, and we don't touch them. Because there's no oil there.
Yeah, and I don't even know if it's necessarily the we want the oil for ourselves anymore. It's the control of the region. I think another big part of it is you have this whole Arab uprising. And in most of the situations, we were backing the dictators. And if an outside observer, you know, maybe an international media sees correctly that this is almost bucking the American dominance of the region. And yeah, we did actually support Gaddafi for the past, you know, since 2002 or 2003, but people have a short attention span and it's easy, I think, for the administration to pick him as the where they're going to go after, because I think they were just waiting on an excuse to intervene in there and sort of try to control the way this whole Arab uprising is turning out.
Your dad grew up in Iran,
right? Yeah, my dad did.
Iran. When did he move here and why?
Before the revolution, before the Islamic Revolution.
In the 70s?
It was early 70s, late 60s. So it was quite a bit before, but he had already seen some rumblings. You know, while he was at the university, they closed down some universities for a semester because of student riots or student protests. He just thought America was the place to be where you could just engage in commerce and make some money and raise your family. You know, he was somewhat right at the time.
Is he Muslim?
No, he's not Muslim. In fact...
Is he agnostic?
Pretty much. He was married to a Mormon for a little while and went to the Mormon church, and they sort of raised their kids Mormon, but my dad would just go wear a suit and smile. He didn't necessarily, you know, read scripture every night or anything.
I've sat through a lot of churches I didn't believe in.
Have you?
Yeah. I went to a religious boarding school for four years, and my parents took me to, you know, my dad was a Baptist Sunday school teacher.
Well, I find that most Iranian, at least, expatriates that came to America, they're not necessarily religious. I mean, they pretty much left because the country, Iran, became, you know, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
If they liked being seeped in Sharia,
they would have stayed, exactly.
They don't want to go to somewhere where people go, you look funny. They'd want to stay somewhere where everybody is believing that.
Right, exactly. And yeah, so I think you'll find that a lot, at least with the Iranian population, that, I mean, you're not going to find a whole lot of Muslim American Iranian Americans, in my experience. Not to say that there's not, or that there would be anything wrong with that.
He came here for freedom, right? Your dad did?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the American dream? He came over here for freedom and economic opportunity, and now I feel like I'm, you know, sort of at the age when, you know, he was just getting his feet wet here in America, and I feel like, where did the freedom go? Where did the economic opportunity go?
He found it, too. He owns, like, four stores or something.
Yeah, he found it. Well, he's an economist. He's a doctor of economics. Of course, you know, it's mainstream stuff. It's not necessarily
the other kind of economics?
Yeah, the other kind of economics.
Not the real kind that we like?
Me and him have had quite a few debates about economics.
Tell me about that. How's that go?
He obviously loves the free market. He's a capitalist. He's owned businesses. He's an Adam Smith kind of guy, but he never got past, and I think a lot of people, it's almost a generational thing, and I think that's why I have hope for the future, is there's a lot of people out there when you're over a certain age and you just can't imagine a world without a government actually working. Even if you can imagine it working, I think his deal right now, because a lot of times when we argue, you know, he's like, you know, you may be right, but it'll never happen. It could never happen. They'll never let go of the power. But I think, you know, when I talk to young people, and young people are always more hopeful, I think that it's a generational thing, and it's a step-by-step process. And I think in each generation, each younger generation will realize more and more how irrelevant a top-down structure of government is and how irrelevant it is for the horizontal structure of people enforcing it. Oh, you're naughty because you do such and such, and that's not the establishment's way. I think those will start and will gradually get smaller until we have freedom, hopefully.
About 10 years ago, Boston Tea Party said, America is the healthiest patient in the cancer ward.
Right. I love that. I think of that. I use that at least once a week.
Do you think that that's still true, or do you think that there are other countries that are more freedom loving now.
I guess it depends on what kind of freedom you talk about. I mean, I did see, I did catch wind of a study recently that America ranked around 9th in the level of economic freedom. And it was a three-way tie, I think, with us and two other countries. I think one of them might have been some South American country. I can't recall now.
America is unique in one way in that different states are different. And my understanding is that most countries are not like that. In most countries, the law is the law throughout the states, unless it's something where it's like an extra governmental thing, like a tribal thing. But in places where there are government, you know, one side of Germany and the other side of Germany have very similar laws. And
right,
the same is true most of the places in the world. And in America, you know, they say that we have 50 different laboratories for liberty here. It comes down a lot to what you're looking for. Like, for instance, if all you care about is gay marriage and being able to carry a gun, you should live in Vermont. If all you care about is being able to carry a gun and have low taxes, you should live in Wyoming. You know, if you consider freedom being supported by the state, you should probably live in California or Massachusetts. If you are into guns and weed, you should probably be in Arizona or Colorado. But really, it's kind of like, is moving to another state, I mean, I think it is valuable in a way. I think that if you're a gun owner and you live in California or Massachusetts, you're crazy. There's no real true free state in America, except Nestlandia or something like it.
Right, right. Not yet. I mean, to me, I dream about that all the time. You know, what if there was even just a county, even just a municipality, even just...
Well, there's something now called the County Project in Wyoming. It's the guy that used to be the head of the Libertarian Party here. Actually, he was the RLC head, then he was the Libertarian Party, and now he's fed up with that, and he's doing this thing called the County Party, which is trying to take over politically one county, or just one county.
Right. And I don't know how big the effectiveness of that is. I mean, you spend so much time trying to take over the government apparatus in a county, and then you have a government apparatus. I mean, how can you really be sure that the people are going to actually dissolve it and take that down? And if it does get dissolved, I mean, then what happens? Other counties are going to come in and enforce their jurisdictions, or the state will say, well...
Or the state or the federal government.
Right. The state or the feds probably have some type of guideline saying you have to have a county officer do such and such and such and such tasks.
Or even that you have to have a county officer.
That you have to have some type of county officer. It's state mandate or federal mandate.
I'm really interested in a lot of the nullification stuff that's going on. I don't know how effective it's been so far, but I'm really into it as a line in the sand. And I think the more states that do it, the harder it's going to be for the federal government to say, you must do what we say. And by nullification, if you don't know what that means, I mean declare, you know, using the 10th Amendment to declare that the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction in a state of something that's not contradicted by the Constitution, which, like, for instance, the Firearm Freedom Act, which has been enacted in a bunch of different states, that says that they'll basically say that guns made in the state that don't leave the state or are sold only in the state don't come under federal jurisdiction. And it's been done in 7 or 8 states. The Wyoming one is unique in that it allowed for the jailing of federal officials who violate it. Of course, no one's tried that so far.
Right.
I don't think anybody in the current Christian Sharia and Wyoming government is going to try that. But it's a nice line in the sand. And of course, the federal government sends you letters saying no. You know, they're longer than that, but they basically say no. And you say why? And they say, because we say so. We're your parents.
Move along. There's nothing to see here.
But they've done it with, you know, they've done it with guns. They've done it with weed. Montana did it with a speed limit at one point. You know, they just said, we don't want a speed limit. And the federal government said, well, you don't get any funding for your highways then. And Montana said, I'm sorry, we'll have a speed limit. They should have just said, screw it. You know,
I think the marijuana situation is a really good case study, because if you'll notice, I mean, the feds will go bust things, and it is uncertain for the dispensaries everywhere in the area and growers. It's still really great. But at the same time, I mean, it has worked to some extent. I mean, you do have dispensaries. It does exist where you can be a medical marijuana patient and go get medicine.
I mean, it's kind of mind blowing to me, because I grew up when I used to smoke weed when I was a teenager in my early 20s, and weed was friggin' illegal, and it was more illegal than it is even when it's illegal now. I mean, you could go to prison for a joint in New York State when I was a kid.
Hmm.
Not jail. I mean, prison, like 3 years in hard time prison.
Wow.
You know, hard federal pound me in the butt prison for having a couple joints.
Yeah.
I wrote a letter to Gerald Ford when I was 12 or 13, the president at the time, and said, you should legalize marijuana. Right. he didn't take me up on it.
He
actually sent me back a form letter that said, the president is very concerned with all of your concerns about America and believes in bringing America forward into the 20th century and strengthening all of our blah, blah, blah.
And then the letter fell out of your hand.
Yeah. But the thought that marijuana would someday be somewhat less illegal, I couldn't wrap my head around it. I thought it'd always be illegal. Unfortunately, yeah. I quit liking it and smoking it way before it became legal. So
I think it's also a good case study in realizing that that's not the full way to go. I mean, even if you have complete nullification by a state, you're still going to have the tyranny and those state regulations and the local regulations. Getting the federal government off the off your back about something is only, you know, step one.
Like medicine. So anyway, talk about medicine and your family's experience, family friends' experiences with it.
Like medicine. Well, while we're on the pot thing, yeah. I mean, recently I did have a friend of the family come up to visit me in Washington State. He has a debilitating disease, one that it's been widely recognized that marijuana is a good treatment for. And so just as an experiment, we decided to see if we could get him some medical help here in the state of Washington. He was here for a limited time, but just the fact that it was impossible, it would have taken days. People wouldn't talk to us unless we had certain pieces of paper. And I'm just thinking this is all because of the government, and it's a nice microcosm in how government regulation can completely destroy something as simple as buying a plant from somebody else.
Weed is so non-harmful. It's so non-harmful. I think it's stupid. I think it makes people stupid, but I don't think it should be illegal to be stupid.
No, it is a choice. And I think that's the first thing people need to realize is that that's what a real free market is it's just that. It's a free market. It's something where you don't have anything that's illegal as far as products. Any voluntary commerce is good.
Yeah.
There's nothing – voluntary commerce is what builds an economy. It's what adds to growth. Anytime you restrict that, all you're doing is restricting growth. You're preventing jobs. You're preventing money from being used to its most efficient purpose.
And a lot of people don't know how pot became illegal. We covered this in detail in our movie, and it was basically a bunch of mega businessmen like Rockefeller saw it as competition to their tree farms, and it could be used for paper, you know, hemp, marijuana could be used for paper. Actually, there's some footage in our movie. It's a little black and white footage of farmers growing hemp industrially with tractors.
Hemp for victory.
We took that from a government-produced documentary industrial film called Hemp for Victory, and it was made for farmers to show them how to grow hemp.
Right. And to this day, you know, shortly after that, hemp became illegal when marijuana became illegal. And to this day, industrial hemp, it can't be grown in America. Was it maybe an exemption then?
It was an exemption because they show a marijuana tax stamp in that film. It was basically saying to farmers, hey, get on this government-subsidized hemp tip and use your tractors to grow 100 acres of marijuana and help America win.
Right.
You know, I think it was during the war because it was for victory. It was probably to make ropes for ships and stuff.
Okay. So again, if it's in the service of the state, then do it. If it's in the service of yourself, don't do it.
That's what they say. Yeah, I mean, the thing with you were talking about health insurance earlier. Even if we didn't wave our magic wand and make the libertarian paradise overnight where nothing's regulated and everything's free market capitalism, there's something that could be done right now within our system that would really make healthcare a lot cheaper, and that's to open up competition across state lines like they have for auto insurance. And everybody fights that. I mean, the Republicans came to the Democrats with that and tried to get it put into the healthcare bill, and they wouldn't do it. And it's because they're in the pockets – really, both sides are in the pockets of big medicine and big insurance. But auto insurance has gotten pretty cheap, and it's because it's they can compete across state lines. You had a little experience buying auto insurance across state lines in my house, in the chair I'm sitting in right now. Talk about that.
In your house. I was about to move up to Washington State for a new job. I had been living in Wyoming, and then I went to Texas to marry my wife. I didn't really have a home. I had no home address. My last driver's license was from Texas, because in Wyoming I never got a driver's license. One of the great things about Wyoming is cops don't tend to bug you very much, so I got away without.
You drove with expired plates and expired tags and a shattered windshield for 2 years here and never got pulled over.
Right, right. And I still have my car is in the same situation. I'm driving here in Washington State right now. But yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, in Texas, you would have gotten thrown in prison in a day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They'll pull you over for that in Texas. Supposedly in California, too. You know, they got the fix-it tickets. And if they see your windshield is cracked, they'll come pull you over.
Well, you know, the thing about registering anything, I heard a really good analogy for it, whether it's your car, your gun, your pet, your marriage, whatever, your business. When you register something, whoever you register it with, you're making them a part owner.
Yeah, they're a party to whatever
is. It's a bad partnership because they're not paying like a part owner would. They're not investing. They're just taking.
No.
Taking and controlling without giving you anything.
Right, right. They take your money and they give you a set of rules to abide by.
And they give you a piece of paper that's official because they printed it instead of you.
Yeah. In fact, on the back of the, I don't know if it's still like this, but my Texas registration sticker says, check the date, love your state. Because they want to make sure they get that money on time. And if you don't do that, then you don't love your state and then you don't love Texas and you're not patriotic.
It's like the King's Highway, and you pay to use it.
They love the royal we. They love to make us a part of their evil government.
I know. I hate the royal we.
Ugh, yeah.
The royal we, if you don't know, is actually, if people are listening and don't know, it's a literary term that is used in two ways. One is sometimes a writer will write as we instead of me. Like, we did this. And it's kind of disconcerting to read because it sounds like the person's talking to themselves or has a mouse in their pocket. But also, kings historically would actually use the word we instead of me when declaring something. He'd say, we have decided that all land abutting up against churches will be taxed this much. And the we is, you know, him and his army, basically.
Right, right.
And and people use that now without even thinking, like, they say, we're bombing Libya. We're not bombing Libya. I'm not bombing Libya. You're not bombing Libya. They're bombing Libya.
Right, right. Well, what we need to do is just make this law that makes this illegal, and then everything will be perfect.
Yeah.
I did buy insurance without giving him I said I was going to be living in Washington State. I didn't have a Washington State driver's license. And he was able to write me a policy that's good in Washington State from wherever their call center was.
And he emailed it to you, and you printed it on my printer and took it with you.
That night. It took an hour.
Yeah. I mean, why can't a medical – if you're going to have medical marijuana, why can't it be like that?
Right, right.
Why can't you type into your computer, I'm sick, and they send you a permit? And
right.
You pay $5 instead of $100.
Why can't anything be like that? And you know, when it comes to auto insurance, we're not saying it's libertarian paradise-y either. I mean, most states do require you to have auto insurance, which makes it right there. It's not a free market thing.
I think the way it would work in a libertarian paradise is roads would be private, and they would have different rules, and some of them would be, to ride on our road, you have to have insurance that meets this certain requirement.
Right, right. And that would be fine, because it'd be a voluntary contract that you'd sign at some point if you were to drive on the roads.
I think in a libertarian paradise, there'd be a lot more insurance and probably as many lawyers, but the lawyers wouldn't be busy doing nuisance lawsuits and defending people against bullcrap laws like drug laws with the state. You know, they would basically be arbitrating independently signed voluntary contracts, and there'd be a lot more written contracts, and they'd be a lot shorter.
Right. Well, it's also hard to predict the way things would look if the government never put such a high importance on the interstate or built this system of interstates and roads and were in bed with the car industry and the oil industry to make it to where you really do have to have a car to interact in modern American society in most cases. I mean, you have to look at what's unseen. I mean, we could be in flying cars, or we could have systems of cities where you didn't really need a car. Who knows how things would have looked if the government never intervened?
Do you know the story about Los Angeles digging up the trolleys?
Uh-uh.
Around World War II, I think right after, Los Angeles had a really vibrant public transportation system, and a consortium of the biggest automaker, the biggest oil seller, you know, gasoline seller, and the biggest tire manufacturer all got together and lobbied the government to tear up the tracks.
Why?
So they could sell more cars and build highways.
You know, and it happened?
Yeah, and it happened. Yeah. I mean, there's horrible public transportation in L.A. now. You need a car. You know, there's that old song, nobody walks in L.A., only a nobody walks in L.A. It's kind of true. But it didn't used to be like that. You know, you used to be able to take a trolley to the ocean from East L.A., but you can't now because that happened. And I don't like the idea of public transportation, but I think it's worse when there's a working public transportation system and private industry says, we want to sell something else. This is cutting into our profits and destroys it.
Right, right. It's still people, bureaucrats in a room somewhere deciding how the future should run, deciding how society should look.
Yeah.
Instead of letting nature decide how society evolves in its most efficient and best way.
Whenever you hear a politician talking about the need for some new law, you should follow the money. I mean, that's happening right now with biofuels. There's all of these redneck middle America politicians who are suddenly environmentally conscious and rooting for biofuels when it's really because all of the people that fund them are corn farmers.
Right.
And biofuels are not an efficient way to run a car. I mean, there could be other biofuels from algae and things like that, but they don't have the subsidies and they don't have the backing to do it. They don't have the private industry non-regulation to do it. It's like Obama's czars have decided all our cars are going to run on alcohol within a year or 3 years or whatever, or 15 years. And so they're going to raise the price of gas and they're going to give a bunch of government money and a monopoly to these industries that run cars on alcohol. And it's not the best way to do it. It actually is going to drive up food prices a lot too.
Right, right. Exactly. The thing is if something works, if it's efficient, if it's where the world needs to go, then it will evolve naturally because of its own natural incentives. If you can make a car that is 70 miles per gallon or doesn't run on traditional gasoline, it's going to sell and you're going to make a bunch of money on it. If the government has to go and say, oh, well, we need to steal some billions of dollars to pay for this thing so it can exist.
Yeah, I mean, I think a good example of that was what you said about, like, we didn't need some government friend finder to find us. We found each other on YouTube, and if there were a government agency and system on the internet to match people up as friends, it wouldn't work as well as just finding someone on YouTube.
No, you know? It never would.
The government actually invented the internet. The U.S. Army invented the internet. But then it spread to colleges, and then it spread to the free market. And that's really why it's so vibrant and what it is now.
Right.
And of course, they're coming in and trying to regulate the hell out of it and put a kill switch on it. I really hope that they do kill the internet sometime, because I think that'll be the one time when the clueless college students who don't care about anything, who just kind of toe the public line and say, yeah, government's good. When their Facebook gets turned off for a week, they're going to notice.
Hopefully they'll put the blame on the right people, because if the government ever did kill the internet, it would probably be in a situation where they said, oh, the terrorists did it. That's why we have to do it, because of the terrorists. I'd like to think people are smart enough to look past that kind of scapegoating, but, I mean, the historic record on that is not great. So,
well, it's amazing to me that so many young people were in favor of the net neutrality bill. It sounds really good on the surface. It's like they make it sound like it's going to keep the internet freer. It would do the exact opposite.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's Rockwell's law. Anytime the government says something, the exact opposite is probably true. Anytime they advise you to do something, you should probably do the exact opposite.
Which is, you know, a really good example of that is the book 1984, which I don't understand how it was written by a socialist, but it was. You know, because basically to me what it describes is the horrors of tyranny. And socialism includes that. I was talking earlier about the Soviet Union. When I was a kid, it was the horror. It was the big, scary, they're going to kill you in your sleep with nuclear bombs people. It wasn't the Middle Eastern. The Middle Eastern people were just the happy makers of rugs. And, you know, it was the Russians. And now it's the other way around. The happy makers of rugs are the terrorists. And the Russians are this thing that's not very powerful and is just a source of cheap rifles and ammos for you and me.
Well, you got to be careful. I mean, the Russians are just on the back burner as far as being villainized, at least by the neocons. You remember when there was the incident with Georgia in Russia? There was a lot of people rushing to the forefront and saying, oh, it's these evil Russians. We must make sure they don't do this.
That was oil. That was an oil pipeline issue.
Well, it's also an influence issue. I mean, since the Cold War ended, America's had a big policy of sort of containing Russia. I mean, you have the nuclear defense capabilities in Poland. That's always the big rubbing point, you know, us having basically this. And we went in and became best friends with all the old communist bloc countries.
Yeah. The thing is young people today who say communism is the best form of government don't have the memory of what communism was. I mean, Russia, communism is standing in line for 5 hours to get your groceries and the groceries to have no selection.
Yeah.
I visited the Museum of Communism in Prague when I was in the Czech Republic a few years ago showing a movie. That place is awesome and terrifying. And one display they had was the food that was available during communism in Czechoslovakia before it became the Czech Republic and had the Velvet Revolution, which was a bloodless coup. And it was this room full of, like, it looked like generic food. It all had, you know, Cyrillic writing on it. I couldn't read it, but there were no pictures on the label, and it was all gray and dingy. And it said that most of it contained large amounts of lead and botulism and other toxins. And it was like, this was under the government, you know?
Yeah.
This was your only choice.
Right, right. Yeah.
That's communism, people.
Communism is the lack of choice.
Yeah. Well, I think we should wrap it up. We got a long, long cast here, and it's good.
Wrap it up, B.
Wrap it up, B. Yeah. The wrap it up box just went off. So if you got some happy words of wisdom for our listeners out there, lay them on us.
Happy words for the listeners. Never lose hope. I mean, if you're alive, then there's always a chance the next day will be better. It sounds kind of, I mean, no homo, I guess I have to say after that, but... I mean, really, honestly, on a long enough timeline, I think liberty is going to prevail, if for no other reason than it's so obviously right. I think eventually enough people will get the hang of it.
And tell two friends.
Tell two friends.
Tell them about this podcast and sit down and talk with people. It's something that should spread.
Really, I mean, once you get the arguments down, it's just hard for somebody to argue that violence is right and stealing from people is a good thing. Yep. It's just a hard position to have, and if you pound them on that, then you'll win every time.
Worms.
Worms.
Hello, freedom fiends. It's your boy Dean from the U.S. Get the U.S. out my bloodstream. I own me, and that includes endorphins. No one won't ask permission, and I won't say please. Freedom fans, one fact that I gotta make clear.
The Freedom Fiends podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license. Do what you want with it and spread it around. Tell two friends. Make copies. Email it to everyone you know. Go on the site and comment. This is a conversation. Every Friday night, we'll have an exciting new episode where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati weave their own unique take on the way the world works and how to find your place in it. Available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com. Subscribe and tell two friends.
And remember, the only power they have is the power you allow them.